Thank you very much, everybody. It's really a great pleasure to visit Toronto. This is my first time in Toronto. I've been many times at the airport hopping, but first time that I visit the city, and it's really a very nice city. I want to thank Ken for the invitation to come to tell you about my group's research. You know, and I'm going to start by asking the audience, who's this guy? Who recognizes who this guy is? Paul Dirac. Very good. So, well, you had a hint there in the title of my talk. This is actually, until recently, I thought this was the only pencil portrait of Dirac. You know, it's at the National Gallery of Portraits in London. I invite you to visit it when you're going there. But recently, I found another one here. You know, it's not as nice, but guess who drew this one? You know, Feynman. Very good. Well, how come you know all this thing? have you been to my talk before? Or? Yes, it turns out that, on a visit of Dirac to Caltech, Feynman, who, besides being a great, scientist, was also quite good at drawing, drew this other pencil portrait of Dirac, and there are two, as far as I know. So how come, Dirac and pencils have a lot to do with each other? And that's because, as probably most of you have heard, and know, there is a number of materials that have been discovered recently where the low energy electronic properties of these materials are described by the Dirac equation rather than the Schrodinger equation. So one of them is graphene, which is made out of graphite, which makes your pencils. Okay? Other materials which have been recently discovered where electrons also have properties described by the Dirac equation are topological insulators, there's a lot of activity here, especially with Ken and other people. So in my group, we do research on these two materials, but I'm going to concentrate today in the properties of graphene. So, this is the real space lattice of graphene. These are all carbon atoms, but I have colored them with two different colors, red and green, because the basic unit cell of graphene consists of two atoms. It's an hexagonal lattice with a two-atom basis. And that has actually dramatic properties, the fact that in order to tile up a honeycomb, you need two atoms, even if they are identical, like it's the case in carbon. This has very dramatic consequences for the symmetry properties of graphene. So typically, these two sublattices, they are called the A and the B sublattice. And I'll be talking about them a little bit, especially in the second part of my talk, a little bit about them. Anyway, you can, in a very simple model, in a tight-binding model, calculate what are the electronic states available for this type of a structure. And this is represented here. These are the energy versus momentum states for such a honeycomb lattice. Okay, and it turns out that this was actually calculated by Philip Wallace, which is a Canadian physicist. Actually, he was born in Toronto, and he's a graduate of the University of Toronto. His most famous work was the calculation of the band structure of graphene. Now, in graphene, this band structure is very non-typical for any material, okay? You can look at and zoom in near charge neutrality, okay? It turns out that for charge neutral graphene, the Fermi energy sits at this plane, okay, where there are six points at the corners of the first Brillouin zone, okay? These are called the K and K prime valleys or points. And if you zoom in near that region, what you find is that the relationship between energy and momentum for charge carriers in graphene is linear. Yeah? So very much unlike the relationship between energy and momentum in most materials like silicon or gallium arsenide or a piece of copper, which is quadratic, is parabolic. In graphene, the relationship between energy and momentum is linear, and that is the exact same type of relationship that you find between, for example, the energy and the momentum of photons. Okay? So particles, massless particles have a special relativity tells you that mass particles have a relationship between energy and momentum, which is linear. Now, photons are bosons, electrons are fermions, and electrons which are described, with this linear relationship between energy and momentum are actually described by the Dirac equation. So one can actually formalize this band structure, and you calculate what is your Hamiltonian equation, and it's written like this. And this is exactly the Dirac equation in two dimensions for massless particles. But there's an important thing. In the usual Dirac equation, this spin or wave function corresponds to the spin up and spin down of the electron. In the case of graphene, this alpha and beta represent what is the weight of the electronic wave function in the A and in the B sublattices. Okay? So in graphene, you have this extra degree of freedom, which some people call a pseudo spin, which represents is the electron on the A or on the B sublattice, okay? And that's what the Dirac equation is telling you about. Now, as I mentioned, we have two inequivalent valleys. The K, there are six of them, but only two are really inequivalent. They are the K and the K prime valleys, okay? And that will also play an important role in the rest of my discussion. So now, people, you know, knew this, you know, since 1947, we have known about this, you know, but it took, you know, 60 years for scientists at the University of Manchester and at Columbia University to actually demonstrate that indeed electrons in graphene behave as massless Dirac particles, okay, as ultra-relativistic particles. And this was done in two back-to-back published papers in Nature, you know, on the quantum Hall effect on graphene, where they demonstrated that the Hall conductance, the transverse conductance of a two-dimensional electron gas of electrons in graphene under a magnetic field exhibits a series of quantized plateaus which are very different from the usual quantum Hall effect in other semiconductors. Okay? We'll get back to that at the end of my, I mean, in the second part of my talk, we'll derive this condition. So anyway, these two papers started, you know, triggered what I call, you know, graphene madness, you know, which is over the past few years, you know, there have been, you know, well over 1,000 articles, you know, written every year, you know, on the subject. You know, is the largest probably of the topics that condensed matter physicists work nowadays on. Yeah? And you know, most of them are actually theoretical. Experimentally, we're catching up. I give this talk, and this number went from at the beginning 1%. Now we're about 30%. You know, experimentalists are catching up with the theorists. Now, graphene, as probably most of you know the two scientists at the University of Manchester, Andre Geim and Kostya Novoselov, got the Nobel Prize in 2010. So you may have thought, you know, that was the peak, right? After the Nobel Prize, then this field has to go down. However, I would argue that graphene is even a hotter topic now than it was then, you know. And if not, you just have to look a little bit to Google or the news, you know. It turns out that nowadays, Novak Djokovic and Maria Sharapova are playing tennis with rackets which have graphene in it, you know. This is not, you know, I didn't Photoshop this thing. This is taken, you know, from a commercial. It's called Novak's new secret weapon, you know, and the contrast here is too bad. You see the graphene on the back. And, you know, some websites, they really mean it. You know, this is meant to be the new, you know, weapon for Novak Djokovic. You know, I think he played already in the Australia Open with this graphene racket, you know. And we will see, you know, how good is that. Perhaps more interesting, you know, for scientists, especially for my colleagues in Europe, the European Union just announced a couple of weeks ago a 1 billion euro, yeah, I'm saying billion, 1 billion euro research program on graphene. This is called the Graphene Flagship Program, okay? And it's going to fund over a period of 10 years, you know, 1 billion euros for research on graphene. And this is because people realize that this material has very unique intrinsic properties that have not been available, you know, in other semiconductors and other materials, and who knows, it may actually turn out to be very useful for technological applications. So now, I want to come back to, you know, to the physics of graphene. I told you there are two things which are key, you know, in graphene that makes graphene very different from standard two-dimensional standard semiconductors, you know, like silicon or gallium arsenide. One of them is this linear energy-momentum relationship versus parabolic. The other one is this spin or wave function, okay, which is the really Dirac thing, okay, versus, you know, a wave function with only one component, which is what happens with Schrodinger fermions. So let me get back to this, okay, two-dimensional electron gas, linear versus parabolic energy momentum dispersion. What are the consequences of this? Yeah? So if you have a parabolic dispersion, and now I'm assuming, you know, here I'm plotting no band gap, okay, so even for a gapless material, this different stays true. If you have a parabolic dispersion, energy will p squared over 2m, okay? Then your density of states is constant in two dimensions as a function of energy. However, if you have a linear energy momentum relation in two dimensions, your density of states is proportional to your energy. And since many properties, electronic, thermal, you know, thermodynamic, magnetic properties of materials depend on what is the density of states at the Fermi energy in your material, okay? If you change your Fermi energy, in many semiconductors, this doesn't matter at all. However, in graphene, it does matter at all because the density of states varies linearly with energy, okay? So that's gonna be an important thing which is going to play a role in the first part of my talk. The second difference is about this role of the pseudo-spin wave function. So If you put a two-dimensional electron system in a magnetic field, okay, so the electrons, the charged particles in a magnetic field, they go in circles. This creates periodic boundary conditions, okay, for the wave function, which goes back to itself, okay? And that means that your otherwise featureless density of states, now I'm plotting a band gap here, but it doesn't matter. Your constant density of states as a function of energy becomes discretized into a set of levels which are called Landau levels. Okay? So your continuous density of states, which is featureless, becomes a set of discrete energy levels. The separation between these discrete energy levels is called the cyclotron energy, okay, for particles in a magnetic field. Now, this is what happens for a regular semiconductor. For a system described by the Dirac equation, okay, it's very different. So let me show you here the difference between Schrodinger fermions and massless Dirac fermions, okay, even for the absence of a band gap, okay, is that your Landau level energy spectrum, okay, this spectrum of Landau levels as a function of magnetic field and Landau level index, each of these guys are characterized by an index, okay? You see here the spectrum is linear in magnetic field, and the separation between Landau levels in energy is constant because it's linear with n, okay? So these spaces are evenly spaced. And it goes, there is a one-half offset here, which means you don't have a Landau level at zero energy. For massless Dirac fermions, your Landau level energy spectrum is proportional to the square root of the magnetic field, okay? But most importantly, it's proportional to the square root of your Landau level index. That means that your energy levels, your Landau levels are not equidistant, okay, because there's a square root here. But more importantly, this n starts counting from zero. For n equals zero, you have a Landau level at zero energy. That zero energy Landau level is the key Dirac thing in graphene. Okay? Most or a lot of the behavior, the Diracness of electrons in graphene in a magnetic field comes from that zero energy Landau level. That's what gives a very different quantum Hall effect than in regular semiconductors. And this Landau level is very, you know, it's very cute. You know, all of these Landau levels are electron-like or hole-like. These Landau levels are electron-like. These Landau levels are hole-like, but this Landau level at zero energy is shared between electrons and holes. And that makes it a very peculiar type of Landau level. Okay? So in addition, something which is also very peculiar about graphene is that, you know, in most semiconductors, you have spin degeneracy, spin up, spin down degeneracy. In graphene, you have spin degeneracy, but you also have this valley degeneracy, this K and K prime degeneracy. The spectrum, the Dirac cone, is identical for the two valleys. So you have what's called, you know, a fourfold extra degeneracy in your Landau levels. Your Landau levels have this degeneracy times spin degeneracy times the valley degeneracy, so you put a four in there. And that plays also an important role. So with this introduction, you know, this is really all you need to know, you know, to understand the rest of my talk, more or less. So let me tell you a little bit about, you know, my talk today. So I'm going to tell you first a little bit about how do we make graphene hexagonal boron nitride devices, because this is a new technology that has appeared, you know, that has enabled a new generation of quantum electronic transport and quantum optoelectronic experiments, you know, because the graphene has improved its quality a lot, you know, by using this type of fabrication technology. And then I'll put some emphasis on the masslessness of the massless Dirac equation to speak about graphene optoelectronics. And then I'll talk more about the Dirac aspect of the massless Dirac equation and describe, you know, unpublished results on the measurement of the quantum spin Hall effect in graphene. So let me get started with this. Now, this is graphite, and these are planes of graphene. It's a honeycomb structure, as I told you before, and they are on top of each other. This material, hexagonal boron nitride, is nearly the same thing. It's also a honeycomb, but you have, instead of identical carbon atoms, you have boron and nitrogen atoms alternating. Okay? Now, the fact, I told you already that these two carbon atoms, the fact that they were identical was key for the electronic and symmetry properties of graphene. Here, because you have boron and nitrogen atom, even though the structure is the same, hexagonal boron nitride is a wide band gap insulator instead of being a massless Dirac fermion, you know, type of electronic structure. Other than that, these materials have similar densities, similar carbon-carbon boron nitrogen distance, etc. But the electronic properties are dramatically different. Now, something that is very nice about this material, similar to graphite, is that it's layered, which means you can exfoliate it very easily with scotch tape, for example. So if you exfoliate with scotch tape boron nitride and you look at it with an atomic force microscope, it turns out to be ultra flat. And for a long time, you know, for many years after the discovery of graphene, people used to make graphene by scotch taping graphene into a silicon oxide substrate. And this is what silicon oxide looks like when you look at it in detail. It's very corrugated. However, on boron nitride, you know, boron nitride is ultra flat, so you can immediately see that if you put graphene on silicon oxide or on boron nitride, it's going to be a lot happier on boron nitride. It's going to be flat on flat, okay? So that's something that is very important. In addition, boron nitride is chemically inert, so you don't get junk on it affecting the properties of electrons in graphene, whereas silicon oxide has tons of dangling bonds and things, you know, which screw your graphene properties a little bit, yeah? So the reason that boron nitride is such a good substrate for the fabrication of graphene devices is both that it's ultra-flat and that it's chemically inert, okay? Very high crystallinity. So now, how do we fabricate these devices nowadays? So what we do is we take a piece of hexagonal boron nitride, and with scotch tape, we exfoliate onto a substrate, and we leave a few crystals of hexagonal boron nitride onto this substrate. So this looks like this, literally. This is an optical microscope of this. This is boron nitride on the silicon oxide substrate. Then we take a piece of graphite and we exfoliate graphene onto this piece, onto scotch tape, which we then transfer to a polymer and then align with respect to the hexagonal boron nitride substrate underneath, and we deposit it on top. Okay? So we place a piece, you know, it is hard to see with this projector contrast, but there's a piece of graphene there on top of the boron nitride, which is on the silicon oxide. Then we etch in a lithographic process graphene into a given shape. For example, this is a hole bar experiment, okay? And then we attach contacts to this graphene piece, yeah? So that we can measure it. And if you look at an atomic force microscope picture of this device, these are the contact electrodes. This is a hole bar, a graphene hole bar, which is on top of hexagonal boron nitride, okay? And this is the way our devices look like. And the thing that we immediately saw when we started to do this type of, you know, this was developed, by the way, in the group of Philip Kim at Columbia University almost 3 years ago. So similar to what they saw, okay, and we were one of the first groups to do this after they discovered this, is that these type of devices, which are, by the way, ultra flat, you know, you can see this is the graphene on the silicon, on the boron nitride, and it's ultra flat, you know, this is flat to a few picometers. If you measure the resistivity versus gate voltage, if you make essentially a transistor out of these materials, the mobilities that you get are on boron nitride an order or two of magnitude higher than they were on silicon oxide, okay? So electrons love to move through graphene, you know, they move ballistically. This mobility, in fact, is determined only by edge scattering, you know, they're moving completely ballistically through the graphene, you know, through microns. And this type of, you know, samples are really amazing for a new generation of quantum transfer experiments. This is going to be particular for the second half of my talk. For the first part, it's a bit less important, less crucial, the quality. Now, so armed with this, you know, type of devices, you know, which have these fantastic properties, let's explore a little bit the physics that we can study with them. So one way to interrogate, you know, the electronic structure and the electronic properties of graphene is by doing optical experiments, okay? You can send photons and then read, you know, the current that those photons generate, okay, photocurrent generated. And initially, there were many experiments, you know, were looking, you know, they would have a graphene device and they would contact with electrodes, and they would shine a laser and they would measure the photocurrent generated, you know. The photocurrent is only generated at the junction between the graphene and the metal. And people thought that essentially what you have is an electric field at the junction that in a photovoltaic process generates photocurrent, very similar to what you would find in a silicon p-n junction, okay, or in a solar cell. However, there were also a couple of experiments, you know, where people looked, for example, at the bilayer graphene, single layer graphene junction. Okay, these two systems have different actually density of states, and they thought that the photocurrent generation mechanism that they saw at this interface was actually probably more related to a photothermoelectric process, which is very different from a photovoltaic process. So what my group was interested in is, what is the intrinsic photocurrent generation mechanism in graphene? Okay, so we didn't want to look at graphene metal junction or bilayer graphene, single layer graphene. We wanted to look at graphene graphene junction. So to do that, what we did is we decided to study graphene p-n junctions. And the geometry of the sample is like this. You have a graphene sheet which is contacted by source drain electrodes, and you cover part of it with a gate. You have a global back gate and a local top gate so that you can control the density of these two regions independently. Okay? We put this into an optical microscope setup, which has also electrical feed-throughs so that we can excite with light and measure current. So if you just measure the resistance as a function of top gate and back gate, you get this thing. Okay? This is a map, you know, which is very typical of graphene devices, has been seen by many people. If you take a cut through here, your resistance versus gate voltage exhibits this peak. Okay? Typical of graphene. This is the point of the charge neutrality point. So the resistance decreases monotonically away from the charge neutrality point. Now, as you can see, this map is divided into four regions. These four regions separate, you know, your gate voltage is such that you have a PN junction or an NN junction here, or a NP junction here, or a PP junction here, okay? Depending on the gate voltage polarity, you can vary the density in the two regions of the device. This point corresponds to the double charge neutrality point of those two regions. And as you can see, this resistance versus back gate and top gate is separated into four regions. Yeah? That's going to be important. Now, that was just the characterization electrically. Now let's shine light onto this thing and see what happens. Now we shine our laser, okay? And we can scan our laser and shine light on different parts of the sample. Yeah? Let's adjust our gate voltages such that we have a PN junction configuration, similar to what you would have in a solar cell. But this is a lateral solar cell. So this is what a picture of the device looks like from the top. And if we now measure the photocurrent generated as I scan my laser spot here, this is what I see. Okay? Now let me put those two figures on top of each other. What we can see is that the photocurrent is mostly generated at the PN junction interface. Okay? So let's now park our laser spot. Well, let's take first a profile of our photocurrent. The photocurrent measured as a function of laser position has this shape. Similar to all of the previous experiments, we have a photocurrent contribution near the contacts. It's negative on one side and positive on the other side. Everybody saw that. But what we see is that the photocurrent generated at the PN interface is much larger than that and completely dominates the photoresponse. Yeah? And it's also, it was quite peculiar, the fact that it was linearly dependent on distance, despite the fact that the spot size is much smaller than this distance. You know, it doesn't decrease exponentially. It goes away linearly. That was already curious. Now, let's park our laser spot at the PN interface, and now let's vary those gate voltages, those densities and those two regions to see what the photocurrent does at that spatial spot as a function of gate voltage, of density in these two different regions, okay? So what it does is this, okay? So this is a photocurrent measurement now as a function of top gate and back gate. These two gray lines are the PN, PP, NN, NP separation regions in resistance that we saw before, okay? And what you can see is that the photocurrent alternates sign, you know, between PN and NP regions, but in addition, there is a sign flip also in these regions, okay? So the photocurrent versus back gate and top gate voltage is separated into six regions of alternating sign, okay? Not four as before, but six. Now, if you think a little bit about this, this automatically rules out that a photovoltaic process is taking place to generate this photocurrent. Because in a photovoltaic process, what happens is you have an electric field at an interface. You generate an electron-hole pair, and the electron goes one way, the hole goes the other way. Okay? That depends only on the sign of the electric field at your interface. Either your relative density is like this, and the photocurrent goes one way, or it's like this, and the photocurrent goes the other way. Yeah? So you can, at most, for a photovoltaic process, have one sign change in this diagram when you go from this to this. Yeah? Here, what I'm showing you is that just by doing this, I can send the photocurrent this way or this way, okay? Just by doing this. And the same thing by doing this. Okay? So this rules out the photovoltaic effect as the main contribution mechanism to photocurrent generation in graphene. So what is it if not a photovoltaic? It's actually this photothermoelectric effect that I was mentioning before, but it's a very special type of photothermoelectric effect. So in graphene, you know, when you generate electron, you know, when you shine a photon, you generate an electron-hole pair, okay? Now, this leads to the relaxation of this electron-hole pair leads to an increase in temperature at the spot where you are shining your laser. Now, if you have graphene with equal density of electrons and holes everywhere, that thermal current is not accompanied by an electrical current because it's just isotropic in all directions. However, if you make a PN junction, okay, such as the one that we made in graphene, now you're breaking the symmetry, okay, and there is a thermal current that contributes to this photothermoelectric process. Now, how does that take place exactly? Okay, so the way this takes place is the following. So when you change the density of these two regions, what you're controlling is the thermoelectric process, the seebeck coefficient of these two regions, okay? Such that the photothermoelectric current is given by the difference in seebeck coefficient between these two regions divided by the resistance times the change in temperature that you have from this spot to these spots. Now, let's multiply by the resistance so that we get the photovoltage, and it's just given by this difference, okay? Now, there's a formula which tells you how does the seebeck coefficient depend on energy or gate voltage. It's essentially the derivative of the resistance with respect to gate voltage. So for graphene, where the resistance versus Fermi energy has this peak shape, the derivative of this function gives you actually something very interesting, a seebeck coefficient which depends on density and flip sign, okay? And now you can easily imagine how, by controlling independently the seebeck coefficient of this region and this region, I can get all kinds of sign changes, okay, by doing this. So we wanted to demonstrate, is this really the way this works, this photothermoelectric effect? Is it really due to the difference between two quantities, which are seebeck coefficient and they have that shape? And what is the origin of this delta T? Okay? So I'm going to tell you mostly about this. This is a bit more involved to describe for the general audience. Okay, so I'll concentrate on this. So, okay, does the photovoltage really arises from this? Okay, we have here the photocurrent, the resistance. We multiply them so that we get photovoltage. Okay, does it really come from the difference of two functions which depend on the density? Okay? So for that, you know, what we did is this trick, and we thought of the following. Since I'm controlling the density in these two regions independently, one with the global back gate and the other one with the combination of the global and top, of the back gate and the top gate, okay? If we do a Fourier transform of these data, we should have two independent delta functions, you know, along the two independent density directions that we can control with our gate voltages, okay? So that means that in our Fourier transform of the photovoltage, there should be two peaks, one in one direction, which is the one that controls the density in this region, one in one direction, which controls the density in this region. So indeed, if you take the Fourier transform of this data, you get these two peaks. This is one peak, and this is the other peak. These directions are perpendicular to, you know, NB is perpendicular to this, NT is perpendicular to this. Okay? So what we can do now is do the following. Let's mask out this contribution to the photovoltage, and let's inverse Fourier transform, and let's see what comes from the other part, okay? And let's do vice versa. Let's then mask out this guy, inverse Fourier transform, and let's see what's the contribution of that function to the photovoltage. And indeed, if we do that thing, we get these two contributions, separate contributions to the photovoltage. If you take line cuts through those, they look like exactly the seebeck coefficient that you expected to obtain, okay? So indeed, this proves unambiguously that this photovoltage is made out of two contributions. You add them up, subtract them in this case, and each of them has the density dependence of your seebeck coefficient, okay? So that demonstrates that indeed, the photovoltage is of thermoelectric origin. Now, in addition to that, we realize that this, the increase in temperature that takes place at the junction is not an increase in the overall temperature of the sample. It's an increase only in the electronic temperature of the sample, which is decoupled from the lattice temperature, okay? And this, the term that is used to speak about this is the term called hot carriers. When your graphene electrons get photoexcited, they remain hot at a higher temperature than the lattice, than the phonon temperature of your system, okay? And we demonstrated this in a series of measurements, you know, which I'm not going to describe. Let me just tell you the physics of it, you know. So why do we generate hot carriers in graphene, okay? As I told you, the density of states in graphene is linear with energy. That means that as the energy goes to zero, this density of states goes to zero, yeah? As your Fermi energy, you move your Fermi energy towards zero. Now, the amount, you know, the amount of temperature, you know, increase in a material when you put some power into it, some heat into it, is proportional to the heat capacity, which is proportional to the density of states. That means that if I divide, you know, the increase in temperature is the power, you know, the heat that I put divided by the density of states. If the density of states goes to zero, this means putting only a little bit of power onto graphene, onto the electronic system, increases its temperature hugely, okay? So that makes the carriers very hot, okay, initially, after they absorb photons. Now, why do they stay hot? Because the key thing is that they stay hot. And the reason why they stay hot is that electrons in graphene do not have an easy time relaxing their energy into phonons. And this is for two reasons. Graphene is the strongest material on Earth, okay, that exists. The bond, the carbon-carbon bond there is very strong. And that means that optical phonons, which usually relax your energy, have very high energies. Okay? So even though initially your electrons have higher energy than your optical phonons, very soon they fall below this optical phonon threshold, so they cannot emit optical phonons. Okay? After that, they have to emit heat into acoustic phonons. And there's a very weak electron acoustic phonon coupling in graphene because of a very big phase space mismatch between the two types of carriers. And that means that electrons in graphene just stay hot forever. You know, they stay hot, in fact, by 2 to 3 orders of magnitude longer in time than they do in most materials. And that's why this photothermolytic process takes place, because they remain hot for a very long time and they can contribute to this photocurrent, okay, to this increase in temperature at your laser excitation spot. So this, which, you know, has been theoretically described, you know, by many people, you know, it was very interesting to measure experimentally, and by now many other studies have confirmed this, you know, even in a more quantitative manner than we did. So let me tell you, so the big difference, you know, between a standard PN junction or solar cell and a graphene PN junction is the following. In a PN junction, you know, in a standard semiconductor, you have a band gap. If you have a PN junction, there's an electric field at this interface. When you photoexcite, you know, carriers, they see this electric field and they get separated. Okay, that's the way a regular solar cell works. In graphene, if you have a PN junction, first of all, there's no band gap. Okay, when you generate these carriers, they generate a hot distribution of electrons and holes here, and it is a tuning of the thermoelectric properties of the PN junctions, which drives the photocurrent. Okay, so it's a very different process. In particular, I want you to notice that in graphene, because there's no band gap, it absorbs light for all frequencies, for all wavelengths. So if you want to make a solar cell out of graphene, you can absorb all of the light that is coming in instead of just the light whose frequency, whose energy is higher than the band gap, et cetera. This can generate, you know, many opportunities for various types of photodetector and energy harvesting technologies, which many groups around the world are now exploring. Okay? Now, having said this, which is, you know, it has a tiny bit of more of an applied twist, you know, let me come back to more fundamental physics, you know, the measurement of the quantum spin Hall effect. So let me go back to that lateral level energy spectrum. I just flip it on its side, you know, because it's convenient, you know, so that you have energy here now and density of states. We have our Landau levels. There is the zero energy Landau level. Each of these Landau levels, okay, is fourfold degenerate. I mean, there are four copies of each of these Landau levels, one for the K valley, one for the K prime valley, one for a spin up, one for a spin down. Yeah? Now, this is the way this Landau level energy spectrum looks like in the bulk of the sample. Okay? Now, what happens when you reach the graphene edge? Okay? So let me plot the energy of these Landau levels now in position space. Here is the graphene bulk. There is the break. And then we reach the graphene edge. In the bulk, these Landau levels just have that position in energy that they have, including the zero energy. Now, when the electrons reach the edge of the graphene, they cannot jump out of the graphene, right? That means there has to be a high potential energy for them, okay? Which means these electron-like Landau levels, they all go up in energy. Those electrons cannot get out of the graphene. Those hole-like Landau levels, they all go down in energy, okay? Because for holes, that's an infinite barrier. Now, what happens with this middle Landau level? What does it do? Goes up or down? You know? So, well, we have four copies of this to go up and to go down, okay? As you may have expected or not, I don't know, but you know, there's nothing here breaking the symmetry to go up and to go down, okay? Now, this is quite interesting. These energy levels, these Landau levels are fourfold degenerate. These ones are twofold. They come from a fourfold, but they, you know, two go up, two go down, so these are twofold degenerate, and these are fourfold degenerate again. Yeah? This is the key to understanding the quantum Hall effect in graphene. Because in order to know how much conductance quantization in a quantum Hall experiment you're going to have, all you need to do is look at how many Landau levels your Fermi energy is crossing at the edge of your sample. Okay? That's the key thing to counting your conductance quantization plateaus. If your Fermi energy is such that it is here, I'm crossing two Landau levels, so I get a plateau at 2 E squared over H. If I shift it up here, I will be crossing these four Landau levels plus these two, so I'll get 6 E squared over H. If I do the next thing, 10, then 14. And if I go in the other direction, I get minus 2, minus 6, minus 10. And these were the famous conductance plateaus measured by the Manchester group and the Columbia group, okay? So the key thing is this zero energy lambda level, which splits into two, giving two lambda levels to each of these sides, okay? Now, this, this behavior is exactly reproduced by this formula where the conductance quantization has a factor of 4 because of these fourfold degenerates at a zero mode, which is gives you this factor of 1/2, this offset, Usual two-dimensional electron gases like silicon or gallium arsenide have an extra plateau here at zero. But here, that plateau is offsetted by this 1/2, which has to do with the zero energy mode. Okay, so this was a story in 2005 and many studies afterwards because these were relatively disordered samples, okay? Even though they were very good, much better already than the silicon, in your computers, It was fantastic, but very disordered relatively to how good it can be. So let's, now look a little bit more closely at this zero energy lambda level, which is very special. I told you that the Dirac equation, okay, has this spinor wave function, which, has the weight of the electron wave function on the A lattice and on the B sublattice. Now, if you look at all of the high lambda levels, not the one at zero energy, but all of the higher index lambda levels, those, the wave function for those lambda levels, n different from zero, they have components both in the A and the B sublattice. Okay? However, if you look at the zero energy lambda level, the n equals zero lambda level, it turns out that that one is valley polarized. If you go out to the K valley, to the K Dirac cone, and look at the lambda level that forms at zero energy from that K cone, it is actually living only in the A carbon atoms. If you go to the K prime Dirac cone and look at where is the wave function for that zero energy lambda level localized, it's localized only on the B sublattice. So that's something which is very peculiar, because that means that for this zero energy lambda level, valley degree of freedom, K or K prime, is the same thing as sublattice degree of freedom, okay? And that is going to lead to very interesting properties, as you will see in a moment, okay? So now I can speak about A or B sublattice or about K, K prime valleys, because I'm going to restrict myself to this zero energy lambda level, to the N equals zero lambda level. Now, at the same time, you will immediately realize that these different lambda levels have different lattice scale orbital structure. Yes, they are either localized on one sublattice or in the other one, okay? Very different. Now, all of the things that I said up until now were single particle picture, no electron-electron interactions, nothing fancy going on in there, okay? But now the samples that we fabricate are of such high quality that we have to worry about the effects of electron-electron interactions. And let me, exemplify what I mean by this. Let's imagine you have, this is a roller material, this is a band, okay? And let's imagine that that band is half filled, okay? It's occupied with half of the electrons that you could put in total. In a single particle picture, those electrons want to be in as low energy states as they can, so they will fill half of this band with spin up and spin down. Now, you may remember from atomic physics that you have this Hund's rule. Electrons actually like to pair up their spins, because they can decrease their exchange, their Coulomb energy, their repulsion energy, by going into parallel spin states, okay? Because that forces the wave function to be antisymmetric and they don't overlap. So electrons would want to actually pair up with parallel spins. For that, they have to go to these upper states, but then they have to pay kinetic energy. So there's a competition between kinetic energy and exchange interactions to see in the end what many body ground state do you get, something like this or something like this, yeah? So that happens under all circumstances in all materials. Now, in the quantum Hall regime, something very interesting happens. Your bands become lambda levels, which, if the disorder is very low, are very sharp. Delta functions, ideally, okay? Which get broadened by disorder. So if you have very little disorder, your kinetic energy price to promote these electrons into parallel spin configurations is very little. That width is very little in energy, okay? So in the quantum Hall effect, in the quantum Hall regime, we say that the kinetic energy is quenched and your exchange interactions dominate your physics, yeah? So now for that, you need to have low disorder, okay? And there's where the quality of these samples of graphene and hexagonal boronitride comes into play. Now, let's go back to this zero energy Landau level. Okay, now I remove all of the rest. I'm going to concentrate only on this one. Let's put my Fermi energy, my density of electrons, such that it's half occupied. Okay, in a single particle picture, ignoring Zeeman, okay, I have magnetic field, but I ignore Zeeman because it's the smallest energy scale. It would be half occupied like this. We have four degenerate Landau levels. And you know, for the experts in the audience, you know, this results in an SU4 symmetry due to this valley and spin degree of freedom. Okay? And each Landau level is half occupied. If I turn on now the interactions, the many body picture is like this. These Landau levels now split, okay, into Landau levels which become fully occupied because you gain from exchange energy, okay, and Landau levels which become fully empty. Okay? So you have four non-degenerate Landau levels. In general, you can have additional symmetries being broken which split these two levels. You know, this thing could split into two. It actually splits into four. And you, what you gain is an SU4 polarization or quantum Hall ferromagnetism, this sort of a spin polarization, except that in this case, it's a lot more complex. So, okay, that was, you know, this is a picture which works in the bulk, okay? So in the bulk, for a single particle picture, remember, you have one Landau level, four-fold degenerate, splits into two as you reach your graphene edge. Now, what happens when you introduce interactions? Okay? In the bulk, you're going to split this into four Landau levels. But in your graphene edge, now something very interesting happens. You have two possible configurations for the evolution of these things near the edge. One is that the two which were up go up, and the two which were down go down. Another one is that one of these goes up, one of us goes down, the other one goes up, the other one goes down. Okay? Let's have a look at these two possibilities. This possibility happens when you have what it's called valley polarization. The two lowest Landau levels are both in the K valley. One is spin up, one is spin down. The two upper Landau levels are in the K prime valley. One spin up, one spin down. It turns out that this splitting of up, down is actually dictated by the valley degree of freedom. Okay? So K prime goes up and K goes down. And that's what you get. Notice that because valley and sublattice degree of freedom is the same thing for the n equals 0 Landau level, such a situation, valley polarization becomes sublattice polarization. All of the electrons in your sample are only in one of the sublattices. They are antiferromagnetically aligned. Okay? This is the many-body ground state that would result from this picture. Now, let's look at the other picture. The other possibility is that instead of having KK, K prime, K prime, what I have is spin up, spin down, with, in one case, KK prime, KK prime there. Okay? In this case, I don't have valley polarization, I have spin polarization. Okay? At half filling, my bulk is spin polarized. Okay? Now, this spin polarization leads to the dispersion because the K prime valley still has to go up. This K Landau level has to go down. Now, in which direction your carriers travel is dictated by the slope of this, okay? Which means that you have the spin-up electrons going into the wall, and the spin-up electrons going into the wall, the spin-down electrons coming out of the wall. So you have this counter-propagating spin-polarized edge states, okay, if this situation happens. Yeah? So this was predicted theoretically. Now, these two behaviors lead, you know, these two different possible many-body ground states lead to very different electronic transport properties for your system. In particular, remember, I told you that the quantization of conductance is dictated by how many Landau levels you cross with your Fermi energy, right? So let's take now a two-terminal measurement for which the quantization of conductance is always for positive plateaus, okay? So in this case, if I have my Fermi energy here, I will be crossing two Landau levels, so I get 2 E square over H. Then I go here, I will be crossing one Landau level, 1 E square over H. Then I go here, I don't cross anything, so I get 0. Then back to 1. Back to 2. So I have 2, 1, 0, 1, 2 E square over H in conductance. For this situation, it's very different. If I'm here, because I have this counter-propagating edge states, okay, if I start here, I'm crossing 2. If I go here, I'm crossing only 1, this one. But if I go here, now I'm crossing 2 again, which then go to 1, which then go to 2. So I'll have 2, 1, 2, 1, 2 E square over H. So it should be possible to do an experiment where you just make a two-terminal measurement of the quantization in a magnetic field, and you see if you have this or this. And you can determine what is your many-body ground state in graphene, okay? In ultra-clean graphene samples. Now, have you heard about spin-polarized, counter-propagating spin-polarized edge states? Ever? You should or you may have heard of it. This is actually what happens in the two-dimensional topological insulators, in the quantum spin hole effect in two-dimensional topological insulators, okay? Which is in a completely different system, in a system where there's very strong spin orbit coupling, okay, you have this counter-propagating edge states, spin polarized edge states at zero magnetic field. Nothing to do with the situation I'm describing, okay? And your conductance, this is the for the topological insulator case, is also more or less 2√h, okay? So this was the experiment done by Mollenkamp group, you know, a number of years now ago in science, okay? I'll come back to this comparison between what I'm talking about and 2D topological insulators at the end. So, by the way, this problem of what is the many-body ground state of graphene in a magnetic field is probably the most intensely studied problem in condensed matter theory, you know, in the past 5 years. This is just a small list of plenty of articles that have been devoted to this, okay? And life is quite a bit more complex than I just told you. They're not possible only those two ground states. There are many, many possible. These are just four examples of many-body ground states. You can have this ferromagnetic alignment, which I described before, the anti-ferromagnetic alignment, sublattice polarized. You can have candidate anti-ferromagnet. You can have charge density waves, all kinds of many-body ground states, superconducting, et cetera. Okay? Just warning you that there's a lot more than I'm saying. I'm simplifying the picture. Let's do the experiment, okay? Well, it's an experimental fact confirmed by now by many people that if you apply a perpendicular magnetic field to graphene and you measure the conductance, you get 21012, okay? So you get the first result that I told you, okay? This was done first by the Princeton group. This required, with old samples, 40 tesla. With the quality of the samples we have now, you can measure this at 1 tesla, okay? So our lambda levels are much sharper and we can do these experiments at much smaller magnetic field. In addition, the group of Philip Kim definitely ruled out that there's any possibility of spin polarization as the ground state in a perpendicular magnetic field, yeah? Now, so, you know, the important thing is actually to look like, to look at what are the energy scales involved in the problem. The lambda level energies and the long-range Coulomb interactions, they're SU4 symmetric. They don't distinguish spin up, spin down, or sublattice A or B, okay? Those are SU4 symmetric. However, there are some energy scales which are anisotropic, okay? For example, Zeeman energy distinguishes spin up from spin down. Short-range Coulomb interactions, okay, distinguish whether your electron is on one sublattice or in the other sublattice. If you put two electrons on one sublattice, that you know, that is felt by that. And in addition, you have disorder, you know. So the thing that some people realize is, wait a moment, all of these energy scales, yes, Zeeman is the weakest energy scale, the smallest. However, it's the only one that is affected by the total magnetic field, not just the perpendicular component of your magnetic field. So eventually, if I apply a billion tesla, this thing has to polarize. The spins have to polarize no matter what, if I apply a billion tesla in plane, okay? So we know that the many-body ground state in some infinite magnetic field limit has to be this spin-polarized state, okay? So what's the strategy? So the strategy is, let's apply a small perpendicular magnetic field so that we split our lambda levels. And now let's apply a lot of parallel magnetic field so that we ferromagnetically polarize our spins, okay? So that's what we did, okay? So we started with B perpendicular 1.4 tesla in this example, total magnetic field also 1.4 tesla. This is just perpendicular magnetic field. Now let's increase it. It takes 12 tesla to in-plane now to do something. The perpendicular magnetic field is fixed, okay? 1.4 tesla, 12 tesla. This thing starts moving, 13, 16, oh, now this thing is rising up, 19, 24, 30, 35 tesla. That's about how far we could go in this run at a very high magnetic field lab in Florida. The conductance that we reach at this 35 tesla parallel is actually 1.85, you know, 1.9 E√h, okay? So what we're doing here is we are indeed transitioning from between these two states that I mentioned. A state which is sort of Bali polarized to a state which is spin polarized. And when you do so, you go from an insulator to a conductor, okay? The real picture of what is happening is this. you're going from an anti-ferromagnetic bulk state, okay? The spins are like this. With the in-plane parallel field, you start to align them. You go into a canted anti-ferromagnet, which then becomes a ferromagnet, okay? When you go to the canted anti-ferromagnet state, okay, if you put your Fermi energy there, you're crossing two lambda levels. That's why this thing goes above 1 e squared over h here with these lobes, okay? And that's a very interesting one-dimensional system that we are studying more. Now, similar work was done in the group of Philip Kim for bi-layer graphene, not as nicely as this, but very similar work. The essential ingredient was there. What we wanted to do in addition to this is the following. One is we check the temperature dependence. This state, the metallic state, is indeed metallic. If I increase the temperature, the conductance goes down, as in metals happens. The insulator state is indeed insulator. If I increase the temperature, the conductance goes up. Okay? So this is the typical behavior that we would expect from metallic and metals. The thing that we did, which demonstrated that this is indeed due to edge transport, is to do non-local measurements. Okay? Turns out that in a four-terminal geometry, you can select which pairs of electrodes you send your current and you measure your voltage. Okay? And this thing leads, it is well known, leads to very different conductance quantization behavior depending on which pair of electrodes you choose. Okay? And this can only happen if the current is going through the edges. If it's going through the bulk, none of this thing happens. Okay? So we demonstrated that too. And in addition, and I'll finish with that, what we proved is that if you measure the capacitance, if you make a parallel plate capacitor where one sheet is your graphene and the other sheet is a metallic plate, okay, it turns out that the quantity that you measure in such a case is the total capacitance is determined by the geometrical capacitance, which is the usual parallel plate capacitor that you study in electrostatics, plus something which is called quantum capacitance, which depends on your density of states. Yeah? So this is such a measurement of capacitance versus magnetic field. These are Landau levels. What we did is we measured in the insulating and in the conducting state the quantum capacitance, and you can see that they fall on top of each other. This is the quantum capacitance at zero density expected from an insulator. So in both cases, the bulk of the sample is insulating. In one case, the transport behavior is insulating. In the other case, the transport behavior is that of a metallic conductor, whereas the bulk always is insulating. Okay? So this was done for the first time. So this thing, this quantum spin Hall effect or state in graphene, is very different from that in two-dimensional topological insulators. Okay? In both cases, the bulk is an insulator. But in graphene, in this quantum spin Hall state, time reversal symmetry is broken. We have a magnetic field applied to it. Whereas in two-dimensional topological insulators, time reversal symmetry is preserved. This occurs at zero magnetic field. Our edge states do not have topological protection. The 2D topological insulators have topological protections, but right here, just in quotes, and no in quotes, because if you compare the degree, how flat this is, the fluctuations around this, this is the best data on topological insulators. It's still not that protected, okay, despite the topological protection. Now, in addition, if you look at what it takes to fabricate these samples and what it takes to do it in gallium, in mercury telluride, these are the heterostructures for 2D topological insulators. This is for graphene, okay? So it's a bit much more of a simpler system to study, which I think will make this system a bit more, subject of many more future studies. Last, something which is important is that in graphene we have many knobs to turn. For example, we can flip between these two many-body ground states by just dialing the magnetic field, whereas in topological insulators, this is all determined by your quantum gold thickness. You don't have knobs to turn this thing or change quantities, okay? And in graphene, you can also couple to other materials, superconductors, ferromagnetic insulators, etc. This is very hard to do with this type of heterostructures into the topological insulators. So with this, I'll skip the summary, and I'll just go to the most important slide. This work was done by a fantastic group of graduate students and postdocs and collaborators. I especially want to mention for the photothermoelectric effect, it was Chon Ma, Nitian Nair, Nathan Gabor, and Titi Tachatanapat. And that was in collaboration with Justin Son and Leonid Levitov. And for the quantum spin Hall effect, it was Javier Sanchez and Andrea Yang, collaboration with Ben Hunt and Rhea Shuri. Ben Hunt is a fantastic Canadian postdoc who's going to be on the job market. You should, by all means, if you have an opening, you should hire this guy, okay? He would be very happy, I think, to return to Canada. And the boron nitride is supplied by the only group in the world that can supply this quality of boron nitride is actually in Japan, and we're also very thankful to them. And I want to thank you for your attention.